This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with me, Caelan Kerwin, and Gary Spain. This week on the podcast, we have part one of our journey through some famous Champions League ties, that's European Cup in old money, and those nights for League of Ireland clubs. Gary will be taking us through some of the great performances, wins and stories that have seen the League of Ireland in the European competition. So stick with us for that. Don't forget to share the show on your own social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. Turn on your notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you can get notified straight away when a new episode drops, plus some bonus clips as well. Now, it's part one of our trip to the continent as we talk about famous European nights for League of Ireland clubs. We'll have the second part next week for you at the same time. Drop us a comment as well and let us know your club's famous European night. And if you were there, let us know what it was like for you. So let's get down to some European adventures. And as you heard in the introduction, it's all about Europe this week on the podcast, going through some fantastic ties that the League of Ireland teams have had down through the decades. If you give us a quick intro, Gary, what are we going to expect? What kind of ties and results are we going to get?
Yeah, so we're going to start off talking about the what's now called the Champions League, but some of us older, longer in the tooth, call it the European Cup, so by mistake sometimes. But it started out as the European Cup, which meant the League of Ireland champions were in it every year, or almost every year, actually, going back, right back to 1957. So we're going to talk about some great nights in the European Cup / Champions League for the League of Ireland champions.
Yeah, and I think that's probably an important thing to point out, particularly in the kind of the early outset of the European Cup, is that it was champions v champions, and that's why as we go down through the years you saw so many, I suppose, glamour ties, if you want to put it that way too.
Yeah, so I mean, if you go back to, let's say, the 50s, 60s, there were approximately 32, 33 countries in UEFA, and for the European Cup, you had all that got in were the champions of each of those countries, and if they weren't champions, the holders, and it was nobody else. So you either won the European Cup or you won your domestic league, and that's the only way you got in. So you had 32 teams. It was normally an open draw. Some years they seemed to have some kind of a seeding, but it meant you got glamour ties and our champions. So if you go right back to our first ever champions, qualifying for the European Cup, it was Shamrock Rovers won the league in 1957. What an iconic draw they got. They got Manchester United. Can you even get better than that? And then you've the Manchester United of 1957-58. It's the legendary, the tragic Busby Babes, the forever young, forever immortal, and so many other people died in that crash in February 1958. But that team played in Dublin, played Shamrock Rovers in the European Cup in September 1957. But even going on into the 50s, 60s, 70s, you ended up with the champions of Spain, the champions of Germany, the champions of France. The big, big leagues, the big, big teams were coming to Dublin or wherever to play our champions.
Where do we start with all this? Because there's been so many ties. You sent me a WhatsApp message the other day about the ties that we're going to cover, and there were so many of them. So I suppose where do we begin with this?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to pick out the great nights, you know, I mean, and maybe gloss over some of the ties where the results were maybe not so good. I mean, we did have some horror shows as well. But even if I do begin and talk about some great nights, you're also going to have, I'm sure you're going to have people listening saying, well, what about this? How can you not talk about my team and that night? And I suppose all we can do is hold our hands up and say, yeah, there have been so many.
Yeah, and I'd like to point out as well that we probably do plan to have a part two of this somewhere down the line as well. So like, if people come back at us and go, listen, how come you didn't put this in? We're open to people's suggestions as well as to what they consider to be a great European night too.
Yeah, and I mean, you have to start, I think, in 57. Okay, the tie, the result was never in doubt, but Shamrock Rovers playing Manchester United in Dalymount Park, they were beaten 6-0, so the result was never in doubt. But I should mention the return game at Old Trafford, because the tie might have been dead, but they put up an incredible show. They were only beaten by 3-2. And Maxi McCann and Tommy Hamilton scored for Rovers at Old Trafford. And I don't know if Rovers are ever going to play at Old Trafford again. Who knows? And what an occasion, and what a night for Rovers to go to one of the great cathedrals of world football and to score 2.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I suppose it's kind of a trait that's kind of happened to, I suppose, a lot of Irish teams as well down through the decades too, is they put up a good show perhaps in one of the matches, but they end up getting absolutely smashed in the second tie or in the first tie, and the opposite, they have a good show. And so sometimes it's, when you look at the aggregate score, it's not always, a fair estimation as to the team at the time, the League of Ireland team at the time.
Yeah, it can be. And I mean, going back, our players, a lot of them would have been part-time. You would have had full-time players in the opposition. And you're talking about ties against some of the best clubs in the world at the time as well. So there can be a huge gap, and sometimes that can be very obvious on the scoreboard. I wasn't planning to talk about Drums Atletico Madrid the following year, but that was one where I think it was 5-1 and 8-0 or something like that. Certainly the aggregate score was well into double figures. And but I mean, you're talking there about the champions of Spain, you know. I mean, you start off in 57 with the champions of England, you get the champions of Spain in 1958. I mean, they're glamour draws, huge ties, you know.
Yeah, and I suppose that's probably where things have changed, I suppose to the modern game. Back then, you're looking for the glamour tie that's going to get you gate receipts, it's going to get you lots of money, etc., etc. Whereas now, because of the tiered system and the way it works, it's actually really, really important that teams get to those qualifying stages and get into those group stages. And it's become much more of a lucrative operation now, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a key point, because for many clubs, and going back over many years and many competitions, even by winning a round, clubs can still endure a huge financial loss by playing in Europe. That's going back into the 60s and 70s. You'd know your way for prize money, you had huge trap costs, and it's only what you could make on the gate. And the problem was, if you're playing away first, you could ship a heavy defeat and you're getting a small crowd for the return. Mm. So often in those days, the League of Ireland club would try to reverse the tie and play the first leg at home, because the tie is still alive, you can draw a crowd, etc. And normally the bigger club would have agreed to that, because in case there's any banana skins or anything goes wrong, they'd have the second leg on their ground to make things right. And in reality, to them, the gate money would have been less of an issue or less of a thing. But Europe was back in those days, was not as lucrative as it is now. I mean, if you qualify for Europe now, you know you're in the money. The more rounds you go through, you're definitely in the money. And if you make the league phase, you're into the millions, and you can't really lose out these days.
Yeah. More painful when it disappears, though, and you don't get through, watching all that money disappear, go away.
Oh, yeah. And the clubs that plan for it and expect that income, and yeah, it stops coming in, or even that you're expect to go through a couple of rounds. I mean, what is it now? It's over 250,000 around, I think. Yeah. You know, it's so important to our clubs, because, and it's such a key part of the budget for the clubs that do compete in Europe regularly.
Absolutely, yeah. And 250 grand, you know, to a big club in Europe is probably a drop in the ocean, but for League of Ireland clubs, that's a huge amount of money as well, you know. I'm going to go by the list you sent me. I'm going to go from top to bottom. I don't know if you've sent me them in chronological order. You can sort them out yourself if you have, because I'm following your lead on this. But let's go with Rovers against OGC Nice, that you've got first of all.
Yeah. So I'll talk about, I did mention the first couple of European Cup, but let's say those ties were in doubt, right? Manchester United, they came to Daly Mount Park and they put six past Rovers. Atletico Madrid absolutely battered drums home and away. But in 1959, the French champions, OGC Nice, who, remember, French football was on a high at the time. I mean, the first European Cup final was 1956 and Real Madrid beat the French champion Stade de Reims. In 1959, again, the final was Real Madrid and Reims. Reims, forgive my French, but Nice actually won the league and they qualified for the European Cup, and they played Shamrock. They drew our champions, Shamrock Rovers, and down in the south of France, away in the first leg, Rovers did not, either they didn't try to switch the tie or maybe Nice didn't agree. I don't know actually what went on in that case. Rovers travelled to the south of France and They first of all had an unusual injury issue in that Liam Hennessy had to be taken off during the game with sunstroke because they were playing in the heat of the southern France. Nice, as people may know, is right down in the south of France, down near Monaco, etc. And I mean, there was no subs in those days, so they were effectively playing with 10 men for quite a chunk of the game. Even though he did come back, he wasn't the same player. But they played incredibly well. Tommy Hamilton, I think, put Rovers ahead after 19 minutes. They did end up 3-1 down, but Liam Toohey with a brilliant solo goal. What a player he was. And people, they might remember the manager given the age and everything now, but he was quite a player in his day. And he scored a late goal to make it 3-2 on the night, and which was an incredible result for Rovers. And it meant coming back to Daly Mount Park, they had a real chance and they were really in this tie. And there was a massive crowd. I suppose the advantage of going away first and getting a decent result does mean you're going to get a huge crowd. And Daly Mount Park was packed to the rafters. Tommy Hamilton, unfortunately, missed the game through tonsillitis and could have been a key part of it. Rovers played incredibly well. Liam Hennessy put them ahead, recovered from his sunstroke. Nice equalised on half an hour. And Rovers hit the woodwork a couple of times. Their Nice's Argentinian centre-half, Gonzalez, was man of the match, according to the Irish papers. Their goalkeeper made an incredible save. And Nice just about held on and went through based on that 1-1 draw. But what a scare they got and what a performance by Rovers. And I know you've been talking to some of the Rovers fans that were going at the time, and some of them still go to Tala. It was a great night, and it was one they came so close. And that Nice team went on to the quarterfinals. They actually beat Real Madrid 3-2, wow. But Real Madrid, same as they beat Rovers at home, but Real Madrid were able to turn it around and won the return leg in the quarterfinal, went on to play in arguably, well, maybe not even arguably the greatest European Cup Champions League final of all time. Certainly one of the iconic ones when Real Madrid beat Eintracht Frankfurt 7-3 at Hampden Park. Who knows? Rovers were part of that European Cup campaign. They played Nice, came so close to knocking them out. And maybe it's one of those European nights and what might have been and what might have happened, just falling short 4-3 on aggregate.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like it's like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. There's a League of Ireland connection somewhere down the line that you can connect to the champions of Europe somewhere. But yeah, that's fantastic. You have here as well. Next is York versus Dundalk.
Yeah, so we had, let's say, there weren't too many even for our club Limerick. Were the champions the following year. I have to give them some kind of a mention, but young boys of Bern, the Swiss champions, were just too good. But let's say fast forward to 1963, and it's probably one, if you look at the first leg result, it's not one to talk about because the Swiss champions, they hammered Dundalk 3-0. I think that game was played in Dublin, actually. I'm just having a bit of a brain freeze at the moment. But I think pretty sure they came to Dublin and beat Dundalk 3-0. But in the return leg in Zurich, which appeared to be absolutely dead, Dundalk took an early lead through Dermot Cross. And on 60 minutes, Jimmy Hasty, we've talked about Jimmy before. Jimmy was from Belfast. He was playing with one arm, but he was a prolific goal scorer. He made it 2-0 to Dundalk. And there's actually, you can look on YouTube, there's actually grainy footage of this game on YouTube. And Zurich were really panicking at this stage. Dundalk had chances to make it 3-0 and either take it to a replay, as it was in those days. But a late Zurich goal at 79 minutes did make the tie say. But the other reason this game was iconic was it was a first win. It was the first time an Irish club actually won a match in the European Cup Champions League. And of course, also was an away win to actually go on foreign soil and to win a game like that. So even though Dundalk were beaten on the night, beaten overall, they did get an incredible win on the night, and certainly Zurich Dundalk is one to talk about from 1963. And another, I will bring this forward another bit, because that Zurich side went, they put out the likes of Galatasaray and PSV and went all the way to the semi-finals, and they lost to Real Madrid as well. So the great Real Madrid side of the 50s and 60s, they didn't actually win that European Cup, but they it shows how good that Zurich side was, and what an achievement by Dundalk to actually go to Zurich and beat them 2-1.
Yeah, and it's going back to kind of what I said earlier, it's that kind of that first leg where things kind of go all askew and go wrong, and yet the League of Ireland club kind of comes back and settles itself and understands and learns, I suppose, from the first leg and goes out and kind of shows what it's really about, rather than kind of maybe in the first tie they kind of caught in the headlights, a bit of a European headlights, and they kind of reassess and go back and make a good account of themselves as well. So that's really good.
Yeah, and I mean, it was Dundalk's first ever time reaching Europe as well. So it would have been a momentous occasion for the club, and maybe the first, I'm obviously guessing, but maybe it became too much for them on the night.
Yeah, so. But the next one is Drums v. Fouverts. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so I mean, again, maybe a little bit of a history lesson that people mightn't realise. There was a country called the GDR, the German Democratic Republic, or maybe better known as East Germany. Germany was divided in those days, and in court it was communist, it was under the influence of the Soviet bloc, but there were some incredibly talented football players and teams there. And our champions Drumcondra, they won the league for the last time in 1965. They were drawn against the East German champions Vorwärts from Berlin. They did actually move out of Berlin after that, but they were still based in Berlin at the time. Great draw for Drums, and on a very special night in Talca Park, they managed to beat Vorwärts 1-0 in the first leg. Jimmy Morrissey headed in a corner in 64 minutes, and an incredible win for Drums, an incredible performance. And to put that in perspective, I will go on to talk about the second leg, but to put this in perspective, the champions the following year, Waterford, also drew Vorwärts Berlin, and they were hit for six in both legs and beaten 12-1 on aggregate. So they were a very formidable side, and that Waterford side was a decent side as well. But in the first leg in Talca Park, great win for Drums, 1-1-0 in driving rain, the pouring rain, but it obviously worked in Drums' favour. And maybe another man to mention that night was the referee, a legendary Dutch referee by the name of Leo Horn. He had refereed a couple of European Cup finals. He refereed a Copa Libertadores final as well, actually. Wow. I don't know if too many people had actually refereed the European Cup and the Cup Copa Libertadores. But he, I mean, he fought with the Dutch resistance during World War II. His brother was killed in a concentration camp during the war. He was Jewish, and he's also, maybe from an Irish perspective, maybe famous that he sent off Jack Charlton in a European tie between Leeds and Valencia back in the 60s as well. And I mean, it's probably worth noting that referees rarely sent people off in those days. There were much fewer red cards than there were today. I mean, I know my father was a referee in the League of Ireland, and I think and in Limerick leagues and every now. I've met loads of people joking, oh, your dad sent me off. My dad actually, I think he said recently, he only sent off two people, he thinks, in his whole refereeing career. And It was much more unusual in those days, but I believe that Leeds United-Valencia game was a war, and there was a few players sent off that day. I can't remember the other names, but
it's funny how we always it's funny how when you talk about red cards from the old days, we always seem to fall back on Leeds United for some reason. I can't imagine why. So tell us what happens in the second leg with Drums v Vouverts.
So unfortunately the fourth leg was played in the driving Dublin rain, and the second leg was played in the glorious sunshine of East Berlin. So Drums were actually suffering from the heat. They still gave quite a good account of themselves. They ended up losing 3-0, but the last couple of goals came in the second half. Drums did have quite a bit of a go, and it was quite a respectable result. And by all accounts, it was a very good game, an entertaining game for the fans. And the East German officials, the Vouverts officials, actually spoke very highly about Drums after the game. Back in those days as well, actually, it's very interesting that the Irish newspapers would always send somebody. So I think it was W.P. Murphy from the Irish Independent was there, for example. He would have been at all the big European away games in that time. Now, travelling behind the Iron Curtain in 1965 would have been quite an ordeal. Ultimately, it wasn't to be for Drums, and they bowed out of Europe, but they certainly didn't go down without a fight.
Am I right in saying we'll get on to Waterford against Man United shortly, but am I right in saying that we're still waiting for an Irish team to get through to the next round? Did that happen yet?
Yeah. In the European Cup Champions League, yeah. We're talking about, yeah. Yeah. I mean, actually, Drumcondra had gone through a round. Another cup. We'll go on and talk about the other competitions. But yeah, at this stage, we still haven't had an Irish club actually progressing in Europe. And I mean, I'll maybe put this in perspective. We will maybe do a separate podcast on the Irish League and the Northern Ireland League. But Linfield actually got to the quarterfinals of the European Cup in 1966-67, which was quite an achievement. But we will get on to talk about clubs getting through rounds, but it'll take a while.
Because we kind of chatted about it during the week as well. We kind of said, look, do we include Northern Ireland? And I think that's probably a separate podcast on its own, because there are a lot of very, very good European ties that Northern Ireland teams were a part of and did very well at times in Europe too. So I suppose that is a podcast all on its own. But we're going to go for another kind of, I suppose, big glamour tie as well. Man United against Waterford.
So Waterford drew the European champions. If I remember rightly, was it Manchester City were the champions of England? So we have to give them the credit in 1968.
Cue the angry emails.
Manchester United were European, won the European Cup in 1968. Sure. I don't think they won the English League. I think it was actually Manchester City, but I would have to actually check that now. But very famous. I mean, what a draw for Waterford. They drew Manchester United. People may not realise the significance of this, but our national team were playing in Dalymount Park in those days. Now, Lansdowne Road was the home of Irish rugby. It had been way back until the 1870s. But even though it was available for football, the cost of renting it was considered extortionate. It was considered too big a risk, even though there was a lot more seats, there was a far bigger attendance was possible. But it was seen as a risk. And up until, by 1968, we had played one game ever in Lansdowne Road, which was the game against Italy B back in 1927. So Waterford made the incredibly brave decision to approach the IRFU and rent Lansdowne Road based on the fact that they drew Manchester United. What a draw that was for them. And they were hoping to sell a lot of tickets. The break even was probably around 30,000 or something. Now, as it turned out, Lansdowne Road was packed to the rafters. I know there was a train up from Limerick. I spoke to someone, he only passed away there a couple of years ago, Peter, and he was on the train. He was one of the few to get in, and he only got in with 20 minutes to go. He said there was thousands, if not tens of thousands, locked out as well. So it proved a huge financial success. And if you think, you're actually looking back now and saying, Manchester United, the European Cup holders, coming to Dublin in a competitive match, of course the whole country will want to go. But it was a huge success. On the field, Manchester United were just too good. Dennis Law hat-trick, what a player he was. Possibly United's one of the greatest of all time. He got a hat-trick. Johnny Matthews pulled one back. He scored for Waterford. They were beaten 3-1. Comfortable win. They went to Old Trafford. Dennis Law went one better at Old Trafford. He scored 4. United ran out 7-1 winners, but Al Casey got the goal for Waterford, so they did manage to score in both legs, but obviously well beaten on aggregate. But what an occasion and what a brave decision it was by Waterford to play at Lansdowne Road.
Can I ask, do we know, because obviously at the time that's the rugby ground, is Daly Mount not available, or because obviously Daly Mount was the, I suppose, the go-to as well for kind of big games too, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, Daly Mount was available, and Waterford had actually gone to Daly Mount in 66 to play Bovart, so it was available. I mean, they made the brave decision to pay the much higher rent to go to Lansdowne Road, but obviously Lansdowne Road had a lot more seats in those days. There were stands on both sides, there was plenty of terracing. Daly Mount had one small stand that held maybe 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people. I can't remember exactly what. Lansdowne Road probably at 20,000 or 30,000 seats. You could charge a lot more for seats. And Waterford ended up actually playing, I mean, the following year they went back to Lansdowne Road. They played Galatasaray, not one I'm going to talk about because they were beaten over both legs. They even played the Hungarian champions in 1973. Wow. The FAI only made the decision in 71, and we played Italy in the European Championship qualifier. And that was the first time that an international was played in Lansdowne Road from 1927 right up to 1971. And even right into the 80s, some of the internationals were played actually right up to 1990. Some of the internationals were played at Daly Mount Park, but gradually more and more were played in Lansdowne Road as the years went on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I suppose it was the success of the Jack Charlton era as well that led to Lansdowne Road becoming the mainstay because of ticket demands and stuff like that, as we talked about on previous podcasts.
Yeah, we did. I mean, that Morocco 1990 was the last game. The last international at Daly Mount, you know.
So we're still on the hunt. We're still on the wait for a League of Ireland club to get through to the second round of the European Cup, the Champions League as we know it now. When do we see this happening? Is it here? Waterford v Glens?
The wait is finally worth it. 1970, Waterford Glentoran. And it is, I've talked about this before.
I was just going to say, we've heard kind of the story before on the other podcast, because it's a great story because there was a match played beforehand, etc., friendly. So take it from there.
Yeah, so if you go back to April 1970, and Waterford, they had won the league, as I said, 1966. They won it again in 68. They actually won it in 69, and they made it 3 in a row in 1970. And they won the league by going to Ballybuffet and beating Finn Harps to win the league. And I think it might have been Easter Sunday, but certainly they had a game the following day for a testimonial for Jimmy McGill, the great Waterford player. Glentoran, the Irish League champions, were coming to Kilcoyne Park to play in a testimonial for Jimmy McGill. Now, and I actually spoke to a player, he's passed away since, that was part of that great team. I'm not going to name the man. And it intrigued me that because Glentoran came to Waterford on that Monday and they beat Waterford by 8-1. And it was explained to me that having won the league at Ballybuffet on a Sunday afternoon, fantastic achievement. Finn Harps hadn't been beaten at home, actually, since the first game of the season in the Dublin City Cup. So Waterford may have celebrated a little bit too much on the bus on the way back. They'd won the league. They weren't too bothered about Jimmy. Obviously, they wanted to honour Jimmy and everything. There was going to be a big crowd. But their main focus was they'd won the league. They weren't too bothered about what sort of performance they put on. Testimonials in those days were, a lot of them, some of them were played at walking pace. I know that. And I mean, they weren't taken seriously.
They were fundraising exercises, really. That's essentially
They were a fundraising exercise. I can remember some of the big ones. Kevin Fitzpatrick he played so long for Limerick. He had two, actually. And I can remember some of the games and some of the players. And there would have been a great camaraderie between the players as well. But in this case, in 1970, Glentoran, they were the Irish League champions. They saw it as a big deal. They were coming down to play this Waterford side, and they took it very seriously. And they beat a very, let's say, hungover Waterford side that had staggered or fallen off the bus. And it was a long way from Ballybuffet to Waterford. It's still a long way today, but in those roads and those days. And anyway, so Glentoran beat Waterford by 8-1. Now, this was, we will go on and talk quite a bit about that Glentoran side in the Irish League podcast. But just to put this in perspective, they had a proud unbeaten home record in Europe. In 1966, they drew with Rangers. In 1967, they played the famous Benfica, Eusebio's Benfica, that went all the way to that European Cup final that lost to Matt Busby's Man United. Benfica put Glentoran out on the away goals rule, and lucky to do so. It was 1-1 in Belfast at the Oval in front of an incredible crowd, and 0-0 at the Stadium of Light. 1969, Glentoran beat Arsenal 1-0. They lost 3-1 in aggregate. So wow. That's the kind of caliber of a side. Waterford were going to the Oval in 1970, and Glentoran were favourites. And I think it's fair to say the Irish League would have been seen as being stronger than the League of Ireland in those days. And but probably a little bit of complacency, and maybe just Waterford got their tactics right. Now, the complacency, Glentoran might have thought they got it spot on at the start. Hall gave them an early lead. They were 1-0 up in the first leg. But a quick free from Johnny Matthews, knocked on by Alfie Hale to John O'Neill, and he blasted home the equaliser in the first half. And Waterford got to half time, maybe a little bit fortunate to be 1-1. Glentoran hit the bar early in the second half. And that was maybe the turning point in the game, because it got cleared. Waterford went up the field, and Jimmy McGill, whose testimonial, of course, had seen the famous 8-1, he scored with a beautiful effort from 25-yard left-footed shot to put Waterford 2-1 up. And Glentoran were very proud of that home record. They threw everything at Waterford at this point. They were 2-1 down. They hit the bar again, hitting the Gibbetley, striving for the equaliser. And Alfie Hale managed to clear the corner to Al Casey. And Al Casey and Alfie Hale swap passes the whole way up the field. And Al Casey finished to make it 3-1. an incredible win for Waterford, a big shock. Now, I mean, that was a fantastic Waterford side. It was a fantastic Glentoran side and a huge win. The thing was to finish the job in the second leg. Now, strangely enough, they actually played their first European tie in Kilcone Park in the return leg, and they did finish the job. Al Casey got the only goal on 57 minutes. So 4-1 in aggregate, home and away wins for Waterford, and the first ever North-South European tie went the way of the League of Ireland side.
Fantastic. And I suppose as well, I know that we'll talk about their next game in the European Cup, Waterford, because they did get through to the next round because of it. But I know you talked about Glens, but we're talking about the Waterford side that ran out with those impressive league runs, and at the time, 6 league titles or something, and 8 seasons, something incredible run. So like they themselves were a great team coming up against a great team, and they managed to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you need to put this in perspective. I mean, for clubs like Shamrock Rovers, Dundalk, etc., you can have debates on what was their greatest ever side. There is no debate in Waterford. Waterford have won 6 leagues ever. They won them in an 8-year period. That it doesn't even get into the argument. But one of the arguments is they are possibly in the argument for one of the greatest League of Ireland sides of all time. 100%, I mean, yeah. You can talk, there's a couple of Shamrock Rovers teams, and you can make a case for the current Stephen Bradley's Shamrock Rovers team as well. Jim McLaughlin's Shamrock Rovers team, and going back. But you've Cork United in the 1940s, won 5 league titles. So that Waterford team are in the argument for the greatest League of Ireland side of all time as well. But without doubt, they were Waterford's greatest ever team. It just doesn't even begin to discuss that. But it was an incredibly talented side. I mean, the names still trip off the tongue, and I'm going to forget some of them, but your Johnny Matthews, your Alfie Hales, your John O'Neills, your Jimmy McGeoh's, Jackie Morley was in that team for a time. Peter Bryan, Jimmy McGeoh, Peter Thomas in goal. I mean, what a team it was, and I've probably forgotten some very, very, very good players in that as well. And they were the likes of Al Casey, even, that I didn't mention there. They were a really good side, and it shouldn't have been much of a shock that they did beat Glentoran, but it was a really good Glentoran side as well.
Yeah. Maybe people consider it a shock because the result up in Glentoran that perhaps wasn't expected, but they did get through to the next round. They faced Celtic, and
maybe for the first minute it was quite close, but I mean, to put this in perspective as well, this is a Celtic team that had reached, they'd won the European Cup in 1967. They'd reached the final in 1970, and hot favourites, they'd actually been defeated in Milan by Feyenoord. So it was a fantastic draw for Waterford. There was no doubt this one was going to Lansdowne Road. And we wouldn't probably be talking about it from a close. Certainly there wasn't too much risk of Waterford going through to the second round. William Wallace put Celtic ahead in the very first minute. He ended up getting a hat-trick, and Celtic ran out 7-0 winners. But the return leg in Celtic Park, although the tie was dead, Waterford did give them a fright. They actually led 2-0 at half-time. Billy McNeil own goal. And Johnny Matthews, he'd scored against Manchester United. He scored against Celtic as well. But Celtic did come back to win 3-2 on the night and 10-2 overall in aggregate. But it was, again, quite an occasion for Waterford to play against another major European giant in Lansdowne Road.
Next up, we've got Bowes v Rangers. Talk to us a little bit about this and I suppose where this went for Bowes.
Yeah, so we fast forward to 1975 because there were a few hammerings in between, and Rangers were the Scottish champions, and it doesn't look that close a tie on if you actually look at the results, but Bowes gave a really good account of themselves. They went to Ibrox. Terry Flanagan grabbed an equaliser in the first half. They actually hit the woodwork in both halves. They played really well, and Rangers got a very late goal and a another goal to run out 4-1 winners, but it definitely flattered them quite a bit. And Billy Young's Bohemian side had played incredibly well. In the return as well at Dalymount Park, Thurrock O'Connor equalised. They drew 1-1 on the night. And maybe another thing to mention, because we will go on we'll talk about another Bowes Rangers game in another podcast when we get on to the UEFA Cup, but it's probably worth pointing out in 1975 there wasn't any trouble. The only thing the newspapers were talking about was a little bit of provocative singing from both sets of fans. But the other thing I found interesting was, and I remember this, you could actually do this in Dalymount in those days, the fans changed ends at half time. And they passed each other somewhere around the halfway line on the old open terrace, and there was no issues. They just walked around each other, and
that is the strangest thing. I have never in my life heard of that. The fans moving from one side to the other.
Yeah, so back in those days, it was actually quite common that you'd actually stay behind the goal that your team are attacking. And on the old terracing and the old Dalymount, you could actually, let's say you were in either the tramway end or the school end, you could just walk the whole way around. So at half time, you'd actually walk around, so you're still behind the goal, your team were attacking. And it was kind of a done thing. It was.
Wow, that's interesting. So I've never heard that before.
Yeah, it's quite. I think it still happens maybe in non-league football in England, where you still have a situation without. If you don't have the fences in place for the segregation, you can still do that. I suppose there's probably security people having heart attacks even thinking about this and managing it. But it was a different time, and I mean segregation wouldn't have been enforced as much as it was. It was a game that passed, or two games that passed out off very, very peacefully. They were to meet 9 years later in the UEFA Cup, and that's probably definitely a story for another podcast. But we will go on to talk about some other games that were certainly high flashpoints and had lots of issues. That one passed off peacefully, and Bowes gave quite a good account of themselves in 1975, and it was a bit closer than the aggregate score suggests.
On then to, you've got Dundalk against PSV here. Why have you highlighted that?
Well, I'm only highlighting it from the first leg, because PSV were a crack team in Europe at the time. They still are a top European side. But I mean, in 1974, they'd put 10 past Ards. They put 8 past a very good Linfield side in 1975. And Dundalk drew them in Oriel Park, and they gave them quite a fright in the first leg. Seamus MacDowell gave Dundalk an early lead, and they played really well. They looked like they were going to hang on for a famous victory until PSV equalised with 15 minutes to go, and it finished 1-1. Now, the second leg, I think PSV got 6. It was never really in doubt. But they went on. In 1976, they had reached the semi-finals, and they'd lost to Saint-Étienne, who went on to play in that 76 European Cup final against Bayern Munich. And having knocked Dundalk out, they went on again to play Saint-Étienne, and actually both games against Saint-Étienne ended up 1-0 to the French side on aggregate, a couple of 0-0 draws and a couple of 1-0 wins. And that Saint-Étienne side, any Liverpool fans are maybe longer in the tooth, but even young Liverpool fans have probably heard of David Fairclough and a very, very, very famous European night at Anfield when he came off the bench and beat Saint-Étienne side that sent Liverpool through and ultimately sent Liverpool to Rome to beat Borussia Mönchengladbach and win a first ever European Cup. So that was the same 76-77 season. Maybe I'm stretching a bit by Dundalk, PSV, Saint-Étienne, Liverpool, but it was quite a performance
six
by Dundalk.
And maybe 6 degrees of league around separation. It's a great game. Play with your friends.
It was a great performance, a great result for Dundalk in the first leg. Maybe one that just gets forgotten about or gets brushed over. Of course, there are many other famous nights to come for Dundalk as well.
Yeah, we're going to move on then to Bowes v Omonia. Tell us about this. Who are am I right in saying that right? Omonia?
Yeah, Omonia, they're from Nicosia. They're the Cypriot champions, and there's a few stories to this one. Well, I suppose one of the stories is we get another Irish team going through, but I had talked about the Rangers game being very quiet and no issues. Another game we'll talk about from another competition was Bowes played Newcastle in the UEFA Cup in 77. There was a lot of crowd trouble, and Bowes were actually forced to play 150 miles, I think it was, from Dublin. So they had to play their home game against Omonia Nicosia and Flower Lodge in Cork. So the first leg was in Cyprus in the old Macarius Stadium in Nicosia, and Bowes were beaten 2-1. Decent performance, decent result. You mightn't be surprised to hear it was an O'Connor scored for Bowes, but it wasn't Thurlock in this case. It was his brother Porrig who played at the back. So I don't think he scored too many, but he scored a cracking 25-yard drive just before half-time to equalise, and Bowes eventually lost 2-1 on the day. But it was a respectable result, and the away goals in those days, they were bringing it back to Cork instead of Dalymount Park. And in front of only a few hundred fans, I think UEFA official site has it down as 4,000. I mean, I can remember talking this at the time. I have checked newspaper reports. There was virtually nobody in Flower Lodge that day. It was a midweek afternoon. There was no floodlights. And you had a few hundred people. There weren't many Bowes fans would have travelled down on a Wednesday. And but Bowes did pull off a 1-0 win. Paddy Joyce, a very young Paddy Joyce, maybe more famous with Shelburne, but he got the only goal on 27 minutes. It was a dull enough game, but Bowes had to survive a couple of late scares and a goal that would have put the Cypriots through. But they hung on, went through on the away goals rule, got through to the second round.
Where they played Dresden, do you mind me asking? I don't know if you know this, but like if they're playing the Cypriot champions, was there kind of an outcry saying that, geez, lads, you should be kind of doing better against the Cypriot champions? Or because I know if you take it in modern terms, there probably would be a big kind of outcry saying, look, you know, these guys, we got to kind of do better against these kind of teams. Or was it like, who cares, we're through to the next round?
Yeah, so it's a funny one. I mean, the Cypriot champions now, the likes of Paphos just beat Dynamo Kiev, right, home and away. And I think the money in Cyprus now is very different to what it was. I mean, back in those days, you would have been expected to go through. I mean, one of the ones I passed over was Waterford, unfortunately losing to Omonia in 1972, which was considered a major surprise and a big disappointment. I suppose it was a case of getting the job done. I mean, Shamrock Rovers were playing Appleball at the time and comfortably disposed of them. So, and I do remember in 1987, watching Rovers lose to Omonia, and it was a major disappointment and a big shock. But that was also the time of they had moved out of Milltown. There was a lot of disquiet among the Rovers fans. There were Rovers fans protesting outside, losing 1-0 at home, and I think 1-2-1 or 1-1 or 1-0 in aggregate. They drew in Cyprus. I can't remember if it was 0-0 or 1-1. But that was considered a disappointment. But of course, in these days, Cork City actually knocking out the Cypriot side in 06 was considered a fantastic result. So you have to kind of put all this in perspective. But I suppose it was job done. Bowes would have been expected to progress over the two legs, but maybe it was a little bit more nervy than it should have been.
Yeah, and they played Dresden in the next round. How did they get on?
They drew Dynamo Dresden, still a top German side, the East German champions at the time. Bowes were able to appeal, so they were allowed to play closer to Dublin. So they had, but they had to play in Oriel Park. So it was a bit closer. It was a very dull game by all accounts. It was a 0-0 draw. I mean, Dresden had five East German internationals on the side, so they would have been hot favourites for the tie. I know as well from newspaper reports, it was actually very damaging for Bohemians financially. So that European campaign, even though they won a round, they were facing horrendous losses. They had to pay for travel costs to Cyprus and then travel costs to East Germany. They had tiny receipts from Floor Lodge. Yeah. They managed to get a couple of thousand in Doriel Park. It was a bigger draw. You were probably able to entice for the Dundalk football public. You also had lights in Oriel Park in those days, which was a big help. Pretty sure that was played under lights. It would have been. So they would have got some revenue, but not to mind the cost of renting the grounds, travelling, etc. So 0-0 draw was a very respectable result. They had gone through a round. They were beaten 6-0 in Dresden. The tie overall was never in doubt. But stark contrast to these days, Bowes and every other club would be desperate to qualify for Europe, not just for the prestige, but also for the money involved. Back in 1978, Billy Young's Irish Champions, what a team they were. Yeah. Unfortunately, the club were losing significant amount of money in those days.
Wow, it's mad to think about that way as well. And I'd imagine it would have been quite difficult. Whatever about you mentioned that, you know, the journalist who had to try and get into East Germany, was it difficult for an entire team and their entourage to get into East Germany at the time?
Well, it would have been easier by the late 1970s. But, I mean, the costs and the logistics and all would have been... I mean, if you actually go back to the early 1960s, Glenavon and Linfield, we will go on and talk about those. They ended up not being able to play ties against Wismut. Well, Linfield were able to play in East Germany, but Vorwärts couldn't come to Belfast. But the Wismut-Glenavon tie from 1960... they ended up playing this last year and this year when the our NRG, I'm not sure how to pronounce the club now, but they were known as Wismut Aue. And so they played Glenavon in a friendly in Aue last year, and they came to Lurgan just there in July for the tie that couldn't take place in 1960. So visas, logistics, everything was a lot more difficult in the 60s. Come into the 70s, the 80s, you could just go through the Checkpoint Charlie. I mean, I did it myself in 1988. I visited East Germany, or East Berlin as it was then.
And it was
quite easy.
Helped bring in a spot as well at the time, as we found out in the in that podcast.
I hope nobody from the Stasi is listening to this.
They've got your picture on a file somewhere in a dark room. Well, that's it for this week's podcast. More European adventures in next week's podcast, including Dundalk v Linfield, Hibernians of Malta and Celtic. We'll have Limerick v Real Madrid, Rovers v Linfield, Pats v Celtic, Bowes v Bati Berisov, Shells in 2004, Dundalk in 2016. So join us next week for that. And remember to support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League club. It's our heritage. It's our game.